Let me allay some fears and so forth, and let you set your timing mechanism. Does that mean I expect to speak about an hour, and this evening somewhat shorter time than that? And I know some of you do want to set your mechanism. Now, there may be others of you who don't do that, and you may think that's a strange kind of thing for a person to do. But let me assure you that it is a characteristic of some of us, and a good deal of relief and satisfaction can be gotten from not only that, but also brief conversations sometimes. For example, take the case of the masochist who one day met the sadist at the corner and said the masochist, "Hit me, hit me." And he told the sadist, "I won't, I won't." What consideration, I ask myself, could lead me to believe that I should address this audience? What topic of interest to you and to me has not already been more than adequately considered during your studies at the seminary? And my guess is that the nature of mind may have received a limited form of consideration during your education here and elsewhere. This topic, the nature of the mind, is of great interest to me, and I believe it is of interest to you. But why should I address this audience? Well, I cannot respond from your point of view, but from mine the answer is both clear and simple. You will each become a significant person in the lives of hundreds, perhaps thousands of human beings. As such, you will help mold minds directly. But the range of your influence will extend indirectly through your congregation or your school to your educational program permitted and demanded by the people you influence in whatever school arrangements are developed locally, be they public, parochial, communal, or private, secular, or religious. And your legacy will extend unto the third and fourth generation. The opportunity extended by the Bodeman lectureship thus entails a great responsibility. Let me begin by exposing as best I can one of my biases, one which will color everything I have to say. And as best I have been able to determine, my philosophic platform is that of conceptualism, as this is understood imperfectly by me. This means, for example, that although there probably is an objective reality to be known, it is so vast as to be beyond my comprehension. Fortunately, my interests lead me to focus upon segments of that reality so that I can comprehend very imperfectly some portions of it. Note that in conceptualism, reality may not differ from what it is in philosophic realism, but the mind does differ from conceptualism to realism. Now, in conceptualism, limited ideas may be discovered in limited circumstances. They cannot, without qualification, be safely generalized or extrapolated to a vast, personally uncharted reality, no matter the degree of faith or belief about that reality. In realism, it seems, the mind can encounter and know with certainty and unambiguously, perhaps even simply, the truth of reality. Now here, to let a parochial aside, I may as well get my hot water out of the air. Some of our greatest difficulties at sinning seem to extend from the failure to differentiate reality from the mind that deals with reality. One may believe and have faith that there is a reality at a particular time. Yet what one actually knows or extrapolate from his experience with restricted samples of that reality, that is his range of assertions, may be at variance with his system of beliefs and faith. A devout Christian lady recently said to my wife, "They say he, capital H, never lives in faith, but everything turns out for the best. But sometimes I don't think he knows what he's doing. Last week, that 61-year-old lady down the street died. She was working and supporting her 85-year-old mother. And now she's got no one to know. There's nobody to take care of her, and she can't afford to go to a nursing home. I just don't understand it. Why didn't he take the old lady instead? One must take care not to interpret answers such as probably, most certainly, or I don't know. Qualified answers about knowledge as landed assertions, not to interpret them as indicating a degree of belief or faith about a two-year-old. One must be equally careful, it seems to me, to not confuse the two categories of answers when using them. But as I started to say, my platform is probably quite similar to one from conceptualism, although from time to time you may find my remarks taken from one or another of the existentialists. Now, with this brief background load, I will deal this afternoon with the broader topic, Interhuman Views of Mind. This evening, the lecture will be focused sharply on engaging the mind in learning. As a result of these two lectures, perhaps a somewhat fuller view of the human mind will pervade your future efforts to know it. This is no doubt an ambitious effort on my part, but so be it. Let's turn to some standard views. When a term interhuman is encountered, more likely than not, one thinks of subhuman. So in terms of learning theory, the work with dogs in Pavlov's physiology laboratory, the training of pigeons by Skinner, or Thorndike's extrapolations from observations of his cat may come to mind. The works of these men have been influential in the modeling of minds in the United States, insofar as they have been used in creating instructional material and learning environments. One must acknowledge the usefulness of this line of endeavor in educational psychology, for it has proved valuable in training programs in a variety of fields. It has also contributed to the identification of learners who prefer, oftentimes demand, highly structured instruction. I fear, however, that the subhuman syndrome has shaped the minds of many learners to accept the principle of contiguity or proximity in time as basic to learning. The consequent schizophrenic patterns of disc jockey banter and television commercials seem both effective and those so shaped, and intolerable, occasionally unwittingly hilarious to those with less shaped minds. But as Sigurd Ryan has said, there is no reason for us to believe that serialized consciousness is master, more God-given than unified experience, such as happens to average people in rare moments of ecstasy. We'll not dwell on this category, that is, learning characteristics of animal mind, but two or three interesting facts are almost always overlooked by the psychological laity, and you should be aware of these. One is that some of Pavlov's dogs evidently developed neuroses. I bet you never heard about that in the education psychology. Another is that reinforced behavior, the unit B.F. Skinner used with his pigeons, for example, is not used by him in his instructional work with him. At least I have yet to find it. The pigeon, you see, as was the case with Thorndike's cat, was practically unrestricted in the range of behaviors it might perform. The psychologist carried the burden of noting and immediately reinforcing the desired behavior, and of repeating this until the basic unit was established so that training and other processes could be attached to the already learned final action. If one were to sit around watching a student perform until he accidentally displayed a desired behavior and then reinforced that act and persisted as the animal trainer, public schools would be transformed overnight. The such disputes over whether reinforcement theory is really being used consistently are parochial in contrast to our topic here this afternoon. Interhuman does not necessarily mean subhuman, as exemplified by psychology based on animal behavior. Few psychologists would deny that humans share with lower animals the mechanisms and characteristics necessary to the kind of learning and instruction alluded to. Many psychologists simply say, so what? The human is a rational being, capable of far more, and our emphasis must reflect this fact. Curricula, which emphasize thinking through the great thoughts of the past, are a characteristic contrast to the training type program. And process education, which often focuses on understanding, application, and inference, provides a different basis on which to develop educational programs which seem to stir and nourish more of the rational human mind. The Oral Hutchins College at the University of Chicago and Stringfellow by St. John are examples of the first few great thoughts curriculum, as is the widely known Great Book Program. Process education, as it is known in its resurgence today, was exemplified by a great deal of the work in the 8-year study during the late 1930s and early 40s. Attempts were made to teach students to apply principles in order to solve new problems, analyze propaganda, and account for familiar phenomena in new ways. The identification as well as the generation of qualified infantry was set. My work on the teaching of hematology in several American medical colleges was of the process type. The results, although not unqualified, demonstrate that so-called higher mental processes not only can be taught successfully, but that the use of such processes is sustained better after a 2-year interval than is the information learned primarily to be remembered. Let's turn to some contemporary musings. Let's not get carried away believing that our current knowledge of the rational potential really sets man apart from non-man. Better glance quickly over the shoulder where one can see the non-living computer gaining ground in the rational era. I have recently convinced myself that a computer can be used very effectively to evaluate effort. It is also useful in dealing with a host of less complex, although often more practical problems, such as evaluating creative design for electrical circuitry, and with more abstract problems, such as searching for patterns of relatedness in hitherto unexamined archaeological artifacts. A few years ago, I would spend an entire course teaching students about test theory, having them laboriously carry out the process of applying the principles to actual test results. Shortly after the course was completed 1 year, one of the students programmed the entire course for a large, high-speed computer, so that the work of the quarter could be accomplished in a few minutes. By examining the program for the machine and the output, that is, the resulting analysis of the test, the students seemed to learn test theory quite adequately. The main point for us here is that the computer was examining and analyzing the test on the basis of test theory. 5 or 6 years ago, a computer program was designed to elicit sufficient information from patients to enable a small computer to diagnose a range of allergies. This was accomplished by posing a number of questions to which the patient responded by typing information, often in the form of yeses and noes. I shall not extend the example, for some of you are already saying that the real work in all these instances was done originally by a human mind, and that the machine merely followed the program of time. But in so far, you have laid the ground for the charge that most of us are machines. That is, computers. When was the last time you did something other than follow a predetermined program or a time? When last did you suggest a new musical instrument, create a new game, generate a new form for music or dance, concoct a new style, develop a point of view which resolves a conflict? Most of us, I fear, bury our potential behind screens which read, "But I am a human, and it is only a machine," assuming that I can do what another human has done, ignoring what only a machine can do, and leaving ourselves both unexamined and unchallenged. And by extension, I fear an analogous use of the screen labeled, "But I am a Christian." Please try to understand clearly, I am not saying that computers, as the most versatile class of machines, have the same potential as humans. I am suggesting that the potential of computers is being explored and operationalized more rapidly than is the potential of humans. This stems in part from the fact that partial human knowledge such as specialized cells or groups of cells for perceiving changes in patterns, for example, are often used to create new testable hypotheses about the potential of the machine. But seldom are machines or other non-human knowledge used to speculate about the human potential, except in the very limited work on animal learning mentioned at the outset. In this connection, I should like to report very briefly some speculations which have arisen from the application of a portion of information theory to data from oral reading. In other words, this is a case where I have taken data and I have now made one of these applications. One can think of a communication system as a process in which a message is first presented, second coded, third transmitted, fourth decoded, and fifth delivered. It's the old model of the telegraph system. By analogy, one can consider the oral reading as a process during which one, the printed material is viewed by the reader, that is, the message is presented. Two, meaning for the printed symbols is set to memory and organized, that is, the message is coded. Three, the message, now as meaning rather than printed symbols, is mapped or transformed into symbols appropriate to the all-all system, that is, the message is transmitted across the brain, so to speak. Fourth, the new symbols are used to organize the vocalizing mechanism, that is, the message is decoded. And five, the words are spoken. At first, it may bother your imagination to try to divide into five separate, clearly ordered processes, but you know that all start was an instantaneous phenomenon, or reading. After all, one does just pick up the page and read. So my investigations, based on the consideration of the process as a communication system, have led me to discern some possible facts which in turn lead to speculations of great interest to me. Fact. Oral reading rate is amazingly stable, varying as little as 5 words per minute over time intervals as long as 4 or 5 months. Question. How is such a complex operation timed? And is the timing highly correlated with the timing of any portion of the autonomic nervous system? Speculation. The little man who decides what is pleasurable or reinforcing in some learning theory also has a time result. Fact. Feedback to check comprehension of the text being read is taken from different points by different people. For example, some people listen to themselves read while others do not. I happen to. Obviously, those who do not listen to themselves could not correct their comprehension from this, the final stage of the process. Others who do listen to themselves might use errors in what they hear to correct their comprehension. First step. Question. Aren't errors in oral reading valid indicators of lack of comprehension? Speculation. Elementary school teachers may have to modify their view of a major source of current information about a student. Fact. Normal speed for reading easy material nearly flawlessly is sometimes far below a student's capacity. This I refer to as the fault low clear channel capacity index. Question. Why would a student knowingly reveal such false information about his capability or potential? Speculation. Our information about clear channel capacity is invalid for students with some type of personality characteristics. But perhaps this set of speculations evolving from data is sufficient to help clarify my belief about the human mind vis-a-vis the computer. There's a great deal more to be known about the workings of the human mind. New knowledge will give us better insight into the potential of the mind. So if you find me applauding the machine boys, do not misunderstand. I am merely anticipating the motivation they must eventually provide for humans. I'd like to go into some extended views now. So far, in a somewhat uneven fashion, we have dealt with animal and machine-based views of the mind in opposition to somewhat fuller views which see the rational potential of the human as the distinguishing human characteristic. But just as there are those who accept the animal reflex as the focal point for human feeling, while still embracing extended rationality as the hallmark of the human, so there are some who accept the rational potential of the human, at the same time insisting that it represents the part of the operations of the mind. And just as schooling of the rational differs from training of the reflexes, so education of the whole mind would differ from schooling. And here I've brought aside the relatively trivial argument that the programs of schooling in today's institutions are misrepresentations of the educational intent of the men on whose writings they are based. For the strong tendency to transform schooling into mere training cannot, I fear, be successfully thwarted today by anything less than a powerful, countervailing force. I don't argue about whether the schooling is really what it's supposed to be. I want to say there's something wrong there. The necessary caveat is that the rational in schooling would be vanquished by some within the camp of the new church. Perhaps we could begin our examination of Fuller's views of the mind with Viktor Frankl's last of the human freedom to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, or his greatest secret, that the salvation of man is true love and in love. But the former of these may still be tainted with rationality, and the latter suggests an outcome, salvation, rather than a state of mind. Perhaps to be derived total consciousness, that fascinating, complex reflection of being that assumes many incarnations in the modes of imagination, remembering, fantasy, as well as perception. Yes, this seems to capture the contemporary mood of conjecture about the mind, and thereby suggest perhaps the substitution of an uneven, coarse texture for education in place of the current, more homogenized, perhaps strict texture of both training and schooling. Perhaps the admonition to know thyself has been misunderstood through the ages. Perhaps what is intended is for one to learn by function rather than rationalizing a range of information about oneself. Quite recently, during a discussion of dealing with emotionally distressed children, an acquaintance introduced me to the term ego regression. It is his firm belief, after years of observing people trying to cope with and help such children, that only those whose egos can regress toward the child's ego state can empathize sufficiently to establish rapport with the child. And said, this regression seems not to be under rational, or at least not conscious control. And so one might begin knowing himself by attempting to sort out sense indications of ego flexibility and separating them from sense indications of ego defense. But this is not intended to be a prescription for education. Rather, we are considering here some fuller, richer definition of mind than the intrahuman variety considered earlier. You see, perhaps, that this kind of consideration quickly transports one from the royal realm of realism to the camp of conceptualism. For no man can hardly entirely, let alone encompass, reconstruct, and transcend the range of experiences which Watson, Dewey, Freud, Thorndike, Hall, and Frankl encountered, and this is to name but a half dozen interested 20th century students of mind. Each of these men has said something important and different about the mind, and each offers some evidence of the validity of his concept. It does not seem to me that attempts to encompass them all necessarily lead to saying both yes and no to the same proposition at the same time. It does suggest that a premature, unenlightened selection of a limiting view of mind is possible. I should hope you might be persuaded to avoid this option. Before you gain the impression that the broader view of mind being suggested stretches only in the direction of theories of psychoanalysis, consider examples of knowing oneself which probably do not speak to man's primary motivation or source, as enunciated by psychiatrists in various fields. In contradistinction to Freud's will to pleasure, Adler's will to power, and Frankel's will to meaning, there may be a drive, perhaps narcissistic, to realize oneself. If not, then the extensive work in the field of bibliotherapy seems basic. An attempt of teachers of literature to parade a variety of characters before the minds of students in an effort to have the students empathize or resonate with one or another of them seems impotent. Of course, the idea of realizing oneself is open to speculation. One interpretation might be that this is but a form of will to mean. I would try to argue that they were different. The will to meaning is thought of as a basic force, whereas realizing oneself is more a form of developing perspective, of noting the characteristic, sometimes absurd form, the activities of the mind are frequently engaged in terror, of providing comic relief which may destroy the little whirlpools of self-importance which typically are to be found in our work. There are some possibly mundane individual characteristics to be realized, characteristics could suggest both the magnificence of creation and the absurdity of much that man has done with that creation. Have you ever had the opportunity to observe carefully the actions of a speaker or a presiding official at a meeting? The patterns of some of those physical actions is usually interesting, often humorous, and always reveals some second or third order activity of mind carried on apparently simultaneously with official responsibility. For example, upon occasion, I have observed the president of a relatively small college for girls as he presided over meetings of the faculty. He stood behind an ordinary heavy library table on which he arrayed his documents for the meeting. He positioned his feet a few inches away from the table and proceeded to challenge both the law of gravity and the principles of anatomy and physiology as he conducted the business at hand. He would lean forward at a severe angle, neither touching his ample stomach to the table, except in crisis, nor raising his heels to the floor. Believe me, he was a remarkable performer. As far as I can tell, all persons who stand while talking, lecturers, teachers upon occasion, and so forth, are also dancers. Although my informal studies are not intensive enough to reveal sets of dance patterns, the recurring individual patterns of foot and body movement, among those I have observed, are fascinating. One man in particular, I recall, included the rapier thrust as his major move. His short patterns of the feet were designed in part to retreat from the thrust position, then to prepare, and then to thrust forward again toward his audience, with a 3 or 4 foot step forward to emphasize a term, idea, or paragraph ending. Another striking individual carries his right hand loosely in his right hand tight pocket, occasionally jingling the tunes he always carries. As he short dance pattern recurs with slight variations, it inevitably incorporates the speaker's glide position. He plants his right foot, raises his left leg backward quickly, and thrusts his right hand deep into the pocket full of strength. In the studies of oral reading viewed as information processing mentioned earlier, the readers revealed enough peculiar characteristics for me to attempt to describe style. The list of characteristics descriptive of style included 1, how they handle style. 2, the extent to which they could tolerate verbalized errors without disturbing their established speed and internal habits. 3, whether the velocity of output was steady, thus congruent with rate of speed, or confessed into short, rapid bursts. And 4, The range of speeds they use for the task, which varied tedious and difficult. I'm quite certain that the speakers and the readers referred to here were at most only dimly aware of the characteristics mentioned. And I am uncertain whether awareness of such characteristics could lead to easy alteration of them. These characteristics are probably manifestations of mind at work at a different level than that used in the major task at hand, and suggest yet another coordinating or scheduling level or function of mind. And this leads one to ask how anyone could set up their educational programs based on simple tuning functions for the mind, when the richness and complexity of the mind is so openly and obviously manifest at every turn. But we cannot close that matter here. Not all of these odd bits of behavior patterns are as innocuous as they may seem. There may be good and sufficient reasons for learning one's propensity for some of this category of activity. For example, consider the possibility that some of us are last worders. That is to say, we insist on having the last word literally, even if the word becomes transformed into a grunt or even a throat clearing sound. One acquaintance who was a last worder would, upon completing a conversation, automatically switch to the word yeah, delivered in deep tones in response to anything further said by the other party. On one occasion, this last worder was talking with another last worder, who characteristically shifted to to close off talk beyond the obvious end of the discussion. Was pitched about an octave above yeah. And the rapid extended exchange of made me think I was listening to a jackass blowing in waltz time. This situation was terminated by each man responding ever more quietly until the moved on. What a scene for a duet in the Verdi opera. But what an irritating kind of situation for the last worder to have to encounter. This must color his feelings about the other person, or perhaps distort his perception of the topic discussed. If you think not, quietly locate the last worder. Engage him in a telephone conversation, and be sure to always to edge in a final word after his standard ending grunt. But keep some distance between your ear and your feet. Before concluding discussion of unconscious manifestations of mind, it seems in order to suggest that Porphyry's original contrast to realism, that is, nominalism, has been lurking nearby. His contention was that we did not learn directly from contact with the world. Rather, the mind took the resulting sense data and constructed reality. Reality always was a creation of mind. Perhaps we sometimes do act as though reality is what we think it is. Let me recite the story of a student who failed a course in chemistry. This is a young lady in her first semester in a school of nursing in this country. Although born and reared in the United States, she is identifiable and widely known as a lot. She received all A's and B's, save for a failure in chemistry. Her difficulty with chemistry was recognized early, and as she told her counselor, she attended all regular sessions of class, all special meetings of the class, and all remedial sessions. In short, she worked diligently, yet failed. She said to the counselor that it was all very strange. The remedial instructor told her that she was translating everything into Spanish in order to think about it, and then back into English. Now this would tend to retard progress even if everything were clear. The dean of the school told her the same thing during the end of semester interview. You were translating in Spanish and then back to English. What was strange, the girl confided, was that she neither read nor understood Spanish. And you may say that this is but one more instance of a person, in this case a student, trapped by having been stereotyped. But isn't this one kind of construction of reality? Whether accurately reflective of nominalism or not, it represents a class of activity for which we all seem to have some proclivity. Perhaps some sensitivity to this tendency on our part would be a good and useful suggestion. So, knowing ourselves is not necessarily restricted to moral principles or will power, so forth. But the latter, tempered by humor and curiosity, suggests in part what might be appropriate for pursuit of education. Sensing and developing an extended range of the functions of mind. Not all of the curious manifestations of mind seem to have consequences, as we know, but some do. And here we anticipate part of the reading lecture. For example, some learners require, even demand, a highly structured situation. It seems that they want to know what they're going to be reminded while they are engaged, and to have the activity reviewed upon completion. In addition, most such learners also prefer not to make decisions along the way. Such learners are in sharp contrast to those who prefer to have a problem and some resources presented, and then to be left to their own devices. When two such contrasting types of students undertake an evaluation of instruction or an instructor, the outcomes are likely to be contrasting. An inventory of teachers and students who know their tendency toward requiring high as opposed to low structure, or to put it another way, prefer no degrees of freedom as opposed to no degrees of freedom, could facilitate the matching of class and teachers to the mutual satisfaction of all. Of course, the moral problem is whether to serve this characteristic or attempt to alter would emerge almost immediately. As the last example of curious manifestations of mind, which do seem to make a difference, let me point to Burns' people play. If you are not familiar with this concept, it seems that any person may play any of three roles, child, parent, or adult. When two persons are involved in conversation, any of one person's three roles may engage any of the second person's three roles. Thus, when one sees two people engaged in conversation, it is not really two people talking as anyone can plainly see. Rather, there may be any of nine pairs of roles engaged. Further, a person may switch roles in the midst of the conversation. The brain, which bears the same spinning from various arrangements of these roles, are well known subconsciously by all of us. To have them available consciously to help us understand and guide our actions could be helpful. It's interesting for me to note the great difficulty in attempting to present and discuss facets of mind without becoming programmatic about education. I apologize for this shortcoming. In retrospect, perhaps it seems that the choice of the term intrahuman was a trick. Upon hearing that term, one might reasonably expect to find a full or complete view of the human mind presented as a concept. That you have not found. There has been mention of subhuman views of mind based on work of animals. There has been a non-human view suggested based on computers and information theory. There have been extended partial human views based on various psychoanalytic schemes, existentialism, and simple observation. These categories could be extended to encompass the mysterious workings of the mind in turn. It has been suggested that programs of training, schooling, and education can be differentiated on the basis of the range of characteristics of mind addressed. The potential of mind has been idealized as a glorious creation. The sometimes strange manifestations of mind suggested as examples of man's use of that creation. But there persists the notion that the kingdom of heaven is within us. What better place to search than in the mind?